Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John Mann on behalf of Albert Price. We submit that when the prosecution failed to disclose that its sole expert witness in Phase 2 was under indictment and had been accused of serious charges of fraud in his professional capacity, that the state violated Mr. Price's due process rights as set forth in Brady v. Maryland and his progeny.
Mr. Mann, I have a problem for you at the outset. It looked to me, reading the decisions of the Wisconsin courts, that the way this was presented to them was that they wanted to introduce evidence of the indictment. And then there's this Wisconsin procedural rule that says that's not admissible. By the time I got to your reply brief, it sounded as though you are now saying that actually the indictment itself might not be all that important. It's the underlying conduct of this man's fraud that you really wanted to bring in. And it strikes me that the underlying conduct may not be subject to the same state rules of evidence in Wisconsin. But it's not clear to me that the Wisconsin courts were ever told that this is what was actually being offered.
No, Your Honor, both arguments were raised to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals that we want to introduce the indictment and also the underlying fraud under Wisconsin Statute 906.08. For whatever reason, in their opinion, they only dealt with the indictment, and they felt that the two maybe went hand in hand.
What I don't understand is I don't think you could get this stuff in a federal trial under the rules of evidence.
Under 608?
608 or 609.
I believe that there is case law in which specific.
But let me, so 609 is about convictions, and 608 is character and so on. But under 608, you're not allowed to use extrinsic evidence. And indeed, how would you? Okay, the person's been indicted. Now, what if he wants to say, "Yeah, I've been indicted, but I'm innocent. They're not going to convict me. That's just probable cause." You can't have a trial of his. Medicare fraud as part of the Price's trial.
Well, I think the key thing here is that it goes to his honesty, the specific conduct.
I assume the federal rules of evidence are constitutional. So, where in 608 or 609 would you be able to impeach a witness with an indictment?
Well, I think. The federal rules are similar in the sense that, yes, an indictment that does not lead to a conviction may not be admissible.
Similar to what?
I think that there is a case law that clearly
You said they're similar. Similar to what?
To the Wisconsin rules,
right? Wisconsin
rules.
Yes, exactly. I apologize.
I'm assuming, maybe I'm wrong, that the federal rules of evidence are constitutional, whatever the Wisconsin rules. So if this indictment wouldn't be admissible to impeach a witness in a federal trial, and if that were constitutional, then wouldn't that
I think
be
that
the case?
That you have to look at both the indictment, the fact that he was indicted, and the reason why he was indicted. He was indicted for fraud, and therefore.
The question is, what do you impeach a person with? With the indictment or with the underlying conduct? So if you impeach with a ruling of some official document, if you impeach with a conviction, let's say it's 609, if you try to impeach with conduct, usually you just can ask a person a question about his conduct.
Yes, and you can also ask if he's been accused of fraud,
or
if he's been.
Where do you get to ask people whether they've been accused of fraud?
If you look at this court's case in Lynn v. Murphy.
But this is not Lynn. Remember, in Lynn, the doctor in question had already lost his privileges at the University of Wisconsin Hospital.
That's correct.
So there was a specific thing, that had happened to him outside the legal process. Now, he was still in the middle of legal process, but this, he's the psychiatrist of the year versus he's a man who's actually lost his privileges because of his sexual misconduct with patients. Quite different stories, which I think is what drove the Lind decision.
Yes, but significantly, he was under investigation for acts of sexual misconduct, so that had not even ripened to the point of an indictment.
Right, and but the hospital, though, had taken the action that it had taken, right? So there was this, there was a completed act that had occurred.
Well, similarly, I mean, the indictment is a completed act, and also, apart from that, I mean, he had committed 15 acts of Medicare fraud, so he had submitted that documentation to the government, and therefore that...
See, again, the question is, if you couldn't admit it under 609, what would you do under 608? Would you just be permitted to ask him whether he was indicted or whether he'd committed fraud, or would you be permitted to prove it, or what?
That's exactly right, that you would be entitled to ask him about those accusations. You would be able to get that information before the jury and let them know that the person that they're hearing for him is someone that...
Says, because 608 says you're not... I mean, it's ambiguous. It says no extrinsic evidence, then says you can inquire in cross-examination. So maybe there's some fuzzy line there. But well, I didn't see your effort to fit what you wanted to do into the rules.
I think that we were focusing more on the Wisconsin state rules, which we feel are analogous
and
very...
If the federal rules are constitutional and you couldn't get this in under the federal rules, then...
Well, I respectfully don't agree with the idea that we couldn't get this in under either the federal rules or the Wisconsin.
Would you explain how, where in the federal rules you get it in?
The federal rules allow for specific conduct evidence that has a tendency to shed light on a witness's tendency for truthfulness and untruthfulness. That's exactly what acts of fraud are. They are
lies. So you're thinking you're going to cross-examine or you're going to bring in the extrinsic evidence? What are you going to do?
Probably on cross-examination. I mean, he presented during his direct that he had worked for these nursing homes. That was part of the experience that he was trumping up, that he had been qualified over 5,000 times. So in the midst of cross-examination, I think we would bring up the point that during that work that he had lied in his professional capacity and therefore give the jury an opportunity.
What would you ask him concretely?
We would probably ask him, have you been accused of fraud
while
working?
Were you reimbursed for this work? What did you bill for? I mean, you have to ask him questions that fit within the cross-examination scope of 608B.
If you just ask him whether he's committed fraud, he'll say no.
Mm-hmm. Well, I...
What did you ask him next?
You could also bring in the...
You talk about bringing in, but it says that specific instances of the conduct of a witness for the purpose of attacking or supporting his character for truthfulness, other than conviction of crime, may not be proved by extrinsic evidence. And then it says they may, however, in the discretion of the court, if probative, etc., be inquired into on cross-examination concerning the witness's character.
So would you go into, I mean, prior to the fraud prosecution, are there findings by administrative agencies in the Health and Human Services
Were there any admissions by him during those state proceedings? Because you made reference to, I think, the number 15 a little earlier in your argument.
Yes.
Were those admissions that he made, were there statements that you had of his that he had either signed off of or in writing or in an... What did you mean by that?
He had not admitted to the conduct because the indictment had been dismissed on a procedural ground, so that had not been vetted in his case.
And wisely not, since this court reinstated
as you're well aware.
Yes.
So I believe, you know, the unfortunate timing of those events doesn't preclude the fact that this evidence should have been disclosed to allow us to investigate further during the trial and to give us an opportunity to give a full sort of presentation to the jury about the type of person they were hearing from. I mean, this is an expert witness, and he was the only expert who testified at the trial that Mr. Price was not suffering from mental disease or defect. The evidence was very close, and I believe in that situation that we were entitled to all the evidence in order to assess the credibility of their witnesses, and we asked for that.
Rely very heavily on our decision in Lind after remand from the Supreme Court, but you have to find a Supreme Court decision which, you know, establishes the rule. So what is the Supreme Court doctrine that you consider governs here?
And particularly answer that in light of the fact that Lynn was pre-ADEPA, and now we're dealing with ADEPA, which totally changes the standard and makes it a much harder road for you to hoe.
We agree that, first, there's Bag, to answer Judge Postman's question, there's Bagley and there's Kyles, which establish the materiality standard with respect to Brady evidence.
So your idea is that you at least should have been told about this potential impeachment cross-examination evidence to make of it what you would.
Yes, and the Court of Appeals should have done a Kyles materiality analysis with respect to that evidence when they decided
that
wasn't admissible.
The Brady violation versus Brady violation is harmless unless you can show that you could have done something with this evidence of the witness's indictment.
And we feel that we could have used it.
So,
we could
then
have,
on that issue,
I could have asked them questions about it, and maybe
you need Supreme Court doctrine that shows that, yes, this kind something, not the identical case, obviously, but that this kind of, that there's a constitutional entitlement to use this kind of the indictment to impeach.
Well, and I think also to answer Judge Williams' question about the post-AEDPA aspect of this case, we feel that there's nothing within the AEDPA that changes the analysis of this court with respect to the narrow.
You're not following. Look, under the AEDPA, you have to have a Supreme Court doctrine, not a Seventh Circuit doctrine, which makes clear that this kind of impeachment that you might have conducted with a was a constitutional entitlement, overriding Wisconsin rules of evidence. So what would be a Supreme Court case that established the principle that you want to apply here to knock out the Wisconsin rule?
Well, as I said earlier, I think that's encompassed in Bagley and in Kyles. As your Honor identified, we don't need the exact case here, but we do have a Supreme Court precedent that establishes when.
So what's the closest?
What? Kyles, I believe, is the closest.
What did that hold?
It held that that if you have evidence that could color the way that you look at all the other evidence that was presented in the trial, or in this case, phase two, that that evidence is material Brady evidence, and we believe that is the.
We're not talking about Brady. You're not following. Forget Brady. Brady is only significant if the Brady evidence could have been used for impeachment, and it could only be used for impeachment if you have a constitutional right to use it for impeachment to override the Wisconsin rule. So my question is, do you have a Supreme Court case that establishes the constitutional right to use this kind of impeachment? And what troubles me is that I don't think we want us to. I don't think we'll find that there's a constitutional right which is broader than the rights conferred by Rules 608 and 609 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. So, what is your Supreme Court authority for this constitutional right of impeachment that you?
Well, I would say one to rely on is Napa v. Illinois, which says that a witness's tendency toward truthfulness is always relevant for impeachment.
But does that override 608 and 609?
I don't believe that the two are in conflict, as your Honor is suggesting, and therefore, if we assume that the Federal Rules of Evidence are constitutional, then I believe that is another principle that we can rely on.
So you're sticking with the cross-examination use, and you're going away from the actual use of the indictment and looking at the underlying conduct for cross. I mean, you have to, mm-hmm. If you're going to make this argument that it's the same as 608, mm-hmm. then I think you have to also back off from at least some of the evidence you think might come in.
I agree that the most important aspect of it is the underlying conduct, the fraud evidence, and I would agree with that. I believe the indictment is still in play for other reasons, but for purposes of that narrow question, I believe, yes, that is what we're relying on.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Mann.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Neill?
Thank you, Your Honor. Assistant Attorney General Aaron O'Neill, Wisconsin Department of Justice, appearing on behalf of Respondent Pelley Phil Kingston. With respect to the Brady issue, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision was twofold. First, they held that there was no failure to disclose the expert's indictment because it would not have been admissible pursuant to Wisconsin law.
What about, though, impeachment using the underlying conduct rather than the indictment?
Under Rule 608?
Yeah. Under the Wisconsin rule, does Wisconsin have some counterpart to
608? We just put a 9 and a 0 in front of them. But under that statute, Mr. Price would have been able to ask about the underlying fraud conduct. He would not have been able to introduce extrinsic evidence of this, though.
Did he want it? He didn't.
That's why I asked, looking at the Wisconsin Court of Appeals opinion, there's a lot of talk of the indictment. But if his request was actually broad enough to encompass impeachment use based on the underlying conduct, so this witness gets up and he tries to impeach, looks like he was not given the information that he wants. And the Brady line of cases does say that evidence that can be used on impeachment is also material evidence for Brady purposes. It doesn't have to be case-in-chief evidence.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Well, I don't understand why the Wisconsin court just says, well, the indictment wasn't admissible.
Right.
Fine. Okay. What about the underlying conduct for impeachment purposes? That sounds like you're agreeing it is admissible.
I agree that it would be admissible.
So why couldn't he get that?
Why didn't the Court of Appeals consider that?
Why didn't the Court of Appeals say, you're right, this is quite material because you're holding yourself out to be such a great guy, and as a matter of fact, you're a liar?
Well, the Court of Appeals went on to hold in the second part of their analysis of the Brady issue that even had the evidence needed to have been disclosed, which I think there's an assumption that it would have been perhaps admissible to some extent, that there was no reasonable probability of a different result had the evidence been disclosed. And it looked at the evidence in two aspects. One, it looked at whether its effect for impeachment to challenge the expert's credibility, and it also looked at the question of bias, which I don't understand that Mr. Price is raising in this appeal. But with respect to the impeachment of the doctor's reputation or truthfulness or untruthfulness, the Court of Appeals said it had limited value because it was a dismissed fraud indictment from the federal government, and this was a unrelated state criminal case.
I don't understand that. I mean, I have a question mark in my copy of the Wisconsin court opinion, where they say, although the charges against Dr. Giannatasio were based on fraud, there was no direct link between those charges and Dr. Giannatasio's testimony in this case. But witness credibility is always relevant. And if somebody tends to be lying to the Medicare authorities in Washington or perhaps the state of Wisconsin, I don't know, I don't see why that isn't, in fact, something where there's a direct link. And as Mr. Min pointed out, he was the only expert who thought that Mr. Price had was mentally healthy, if you will, or didn't have enough of a defect to make a difference.
That is true, but looking at a Brady claim, you have to look the evidence, had it been disclosed, to the extent that it would have been allowed to be asked about.
Well, it would have been allowed as impeachment evidence, you've said.
Right.
The underlying conduct, which the Wisconsin court never seems to think about.
No, they don't. But
so why isn't that a mistake, or at least an unaddressed possibility that takes us outside of AEDPA?
I don't believe it takes us outside of the
AEDPA. When a state court doesn't reach an issue, we don't have to review it under AEDPA.
Right, but this court could review the Wisconsin Court of Appeals' conclusion that the evidence wasn't admissible under a de novo standard of review.
But you've agreed that the underlying conduct was admissible. We accept fully the Wisconsin, or at least I accept fully, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals' statement that Wisconsin law does not permit the use of the indictment itself. It seems like a reasonable rule. Looks to me like that's the same in the federal side. But if we've moved beyond that, if you kind of won on that point, but we moved beyond that, then what do we do with the fact that there's silence on this other theory?
This court could then, of course, conclude that the evidence would have been admissible under 906 08, but you have to then look at the effect of admitting that evidence under that statute. And under that statute, all Mr. Price could have asked of Dr. Giannantaggio was whether he had ever submitted fraudulent claims to the Medicare program or something along those lines, to which Dr. Giannantaggio would have, I can only assume, would have said no, or maybe he would have invoked his privilege against incriminating himself.
Well, right, that and that would have been major
right.
if he did that, because then the trial court may have thrown all of his testimony out for his refusal to answer that question. I mean, that would be a serious issue in the trial.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, I think the more likely answer from Dr. Giannantaggio, given that the indictment had been dismissed at the time that he was retained, the time he examined Mr. Price, and at the time he testified, it had been dismissed.
Yeah, but it was dismissed, but it was under the government. It was under appeal, wasn't it?
Yes.
The government was appealing the
dismissal. District judge.
Right, so it was still a very real threat with respect to him. So I mean, it's more likely that he would have taken the Fifth. I mean, this way, it wasn't like the indictment was dismissed with prejudice, never to be seen again.
It was dismissed with prejudice, though. But this court held that it was erroneous to do so.
I meant dismissed with prejudice, time passes for the government to appeal, right. Totally dead.
Right.
I'm talking about the government had appealed it, had appealed the dismissal, correct?
Yes.
Right. So it would have been very foolhardy of him to answer the question when that was still unresolved, how the court was going to handle that. So there's probably a great likelihood he would have taken the Fifth.
Or he certainly wouldn't want to commit perjury,
right,
and say something that was easily provable.
Well, it wasn't easily provable at the time.
Well, he was under oath as well, and so there's only so far, I presume, he would have gone in misrepresenting his mm-hmm. status during cross-examination.
Yes.
Now, the Wisconsin court, unless I'm missing something, it said that Price argues that his due process rights were violated when the prosecution did not disclose the indictment.
Yes.
And and then it goes on to say,
You're looking at the district court's opinion. The Wisconsin court opinion is this sideways thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So where is it that they discuss his... I'm trying to find the indictment.
Are you looking at the State Court of Appeals decision?
The Wisconsin mm-hmm. court, yeah. What
around
paragraph 7?
802, A03, paragraph
right.
6, okay. 7.
Thanks.
I think is what you're looking for.
It's 7, that's what you... Middle of 7.
I was unclear whether the court here was talking about. You see, if you look at the very last sentence on the bottom of left-hand column of A03, says any error in disclosing dismissed indictment was harmless error, is the court mm-hmm. discussing the possibility of actually using the underlying evidence or the indictment itself?
It's not clear.
Not clear from the discussion. I wonder
The Court of Appeals speaks in terms of harmless error in their analysis of the materiality.
If you look at A2 on the right-hand column, it says, shortly before paragraph 8, therefore Dr. Giannantaggio cannot have been impeached with a dismissed indictment. So my question is, was Price arguing at that point that even if he couldn't use the indictment as impeachment, he could have or would have wanted to use
the underlying facts.
The underlying fraud.
If I remember the state court record correctly and his brief in the Court of Appeals, I think the focus was on the indictment, although he did brief the issue of using it under 908-06, but I still think he spoke about it in the context of the indictment, although I may be incorrect.
Can I just ask him about the second issue?
Sure.
You know, Price argues that there are at least 12 documented instances of past mental illness. Couldn't this information have been pertinent in helping the court-appointed expert formulate an opinion regarding his sanity?
This arises in the context of ineffective assistance
right.
of counsel.
I understand.
And at the post-conviction, the pre-appeal post-conviction hearings, there was the court-appointed expert was never called to be asked about whether that information would have, in fact, affected his decision. So I think that the Court of Appeals concluded that Mr. Price had not shown he was prejudiced by his counsel's conduct, and whether that information might have helped him, I think at this point is really only speculative to guess.
Okay, thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Mr. Min? Well, you can have another minute.
Well, I just wanted to address very briefly Judge Williams' point about the ineffective assistance of counsel.
Do you show prejudice?
Well,
that's what you have to deal with.
I would submit that prejudice is shown by having the court rely on and the trier of fact rely on an expert's opinion that was not grounded in all the available information. And in the post-conviction proceeding, we had Mr. Price's expert testify that when an expert is considering someone's mental condition, these are exactly the types of things that they need to consider: the past history of mental illness, hospitalizations in the past, and all this information was available to Mr. Price's trial counsel, and yet, for whatever reason, not delivered to the court-appointed, neutral expert.
But the expert didn't testify that it would have made a difference in terms of the finding of competency.
I don't believe that's correct. What the expert testified to was that because he couldn't individually assess the credibility of the individuals who were testifying in those witness reports and things like that, that he didn't know
if... These are the bystander witnesses?
Yes, exactly.
So he doesn't say anything about history being pertinent
right.
to him or not.
Well, no, you're right, he doesn't say anything about that. But I would say even with respect to the bystander witnesses, he was actually only speaking for family and friends' accounts, and that's why he had a concern about bias. But with the bystanders, he wasn't even aware that they existed, and there were over 50 counts of witnesses who had no reason to change or color their testimony in any way. These were, you know, firefighters who were on the scene, and those that information was not made available to the court-appointed expert as well. I see that my time is up.
You said in your brief that the State Court of Appeals didn't discuss the... this alternative ground that you could have impeached with the evidence underlying the indictment as opposed to the indictment itself. But is that clear in the... I'm looking at this left-hand column on page A03.
I believe the problem is that...
See, although the charges against Dr. Giannatasio was based on fraud, there was no direct link between those charges and Dr. Giannatasio's testimony. They're not talking about the indictment. They're talking about the evidence.
They're saying
the fact that there was evidence of fraud, Medicare fraud, didn't infect his testimony. Right?
Exactly. And the real question is,
your claim is that the Court of Appeals was wrong to say, was mistaken, to say there was no infection of the Giannatasio's credibility by this Medicare fraud. Now, what is our standard for reviewing that determination by the Court of Appeals?
Incorrect and unreasonable, I believe.
Incorrect and
so are you using an AEDPA standard or are you using
yes,
a
non-AEDPA standard?
Yes,
an AEDPA.
You agree that this is under the AEDPA?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So we have to find it's unreasonable determination?
Yes.
Why would it be unreasonable rather than just different from what we would conclude?
Well, because
question, you know, it's Medicare fraud, it's unrelated, it's about billing, you know, about billing the government, and it's not about your opinion on someone's sanity. So if they say that, how are we supposed to second-guess that?
Because I think the question is past instances of fraud relevant to his credibility, his tendency to be honest? And that was a question that the Court of Appeals never addressed. It's not whether the two are connected in terms of his testimony, but does it bear on his credibility? And I believe it clearly does. Thank you.
I know, but the court, Wisconsin court, discussed that, right?
No, they did only a relevance analysis.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Minn. And you were requested to represent Mr. Price, and we thank you for your efforts on his behalf.